I have the honor of having been appointed to represent Mr. Durand in this case. There's been a lot of ink spilled in this case. Luckily, the request for a letter brief from this court kind of boiled it down and made it a little more succinct, but I will start at the beginning anyway, to a certain extent. Mr. Durand is serving life after being convicted of sexual exploitation of a minor because of the recidivist provision, because of a prior conviction he had for a violation of a Louisiana statute which outlaws lewd and lascivious conduct upon a person of a minor or in the presence of a minor. Now, the federal recidivist statute requires that the previous state conviction be one that mirrors the federal law. That is, something that would be a federal conviction or would be a federal offense if there were a federal jurisdictional hook involved in the case. And there's not. The issue in this case arises from the fact that the state statute doesn't really have any federal analog. That's because it's a broad statute outlawing lewd and lascivious conduct upon a person or a minor. And all potential analogs in the federal court require some kind of contact upon the person or actual conduct with the minor that's involved.
Well, counsel, let me ask you, I think the government might disagree with even your premises here. It interprets the statute, the state sex offense means an offense under state law punishable by more than a year, and that covers this conviction.
Right, that counts.
And consists of conduct. And it decouples between the elements of the crime for which the one-year sentence arose and the conduct. I wish you would address, what do you make of that argument?
That's where we go right into the subject matter of the letter. If we're talking about the modified categorical approach, which is what you defined there, we're talking about...
I'm not sure we are. I think the government says this really isn't categorical, modified categorical. This is not the Armed Career Criminal Act. This is a more generally written statute that talks about conduct.
Well, if we get to conduct, that's where we have a problem, because there's nothing here that defines what the actual conduct was. If you're talking about conduct, either the way we're structured with the way we're putting it together now, simply under the statute, or under the analogous armed career offender statute, we have to go back and see what the actual behavior was if we're not looking at the elements of the statute. And that's where the government has a problem. And that is because this predicate offense was the result of a very, very loose Alford plea. When Mr. Duranda pled guilty and the state was able to find it, the heroic effort was able to find the transcript late on, it was the most Alford plea I've ever seen. The lawyer did a great job. He every time someone came up, the client knew to say, I'm pleading guilty because it's in my best interest to do so, and he admitted to nothing. And the judge accepts this. But if you go, I think it's five or six times, he pointedly says nothing,
he admitted the nature of the Alford plea. He admitted that they had the evidence to prove he was guilty of the crime as charged.
I don't think his statements go quite that far. He said it's in my best interest to plead guilty.
But that's the nature of an Alford plea.
But
contesting the sufficiency of the evidence with respect to guilt. You're just not enumerating what your offenses were.
But at the same time, the statute is so broad, it would allow for conduct which would in no way be analogous to the federal statute and would not involve direct contact. There is a factual basis.
But for the PSR?
There wasn't one.
In state court. Right.
And that's where it counts.
Right.
Now, something is said. Now, I've got to be upfront or backhanded one way or the other, but the prosecutor does make a statement at the very end of everything. After the last of the many times the defendant says, this is an Alford plea, I'm admitting to nothing, then the state talks about the initial report from the children about involvement with the stepfather. It's a fairly short paragraph. It's in the government's letter brief on page 2. Nothing else is ever said to the defendant after that. It's over by that time. That's it. He says it, and I don't think the court even responds after that point, other than to record the conviction. So there is no admission by the defendant. And the cases this court directed us to, admission was important. The fact that there had been a long factual basis in the cases, and they are armed career offender cases. But there's nothing else that seems to be analogous in those in that regard. And the result here is that we've got these two entirely different types of behavior. We've got the photographic session in the park in Alexandria. I know that consent is impossible.
I mean, are they really different? The problem is that he's a child predator. That's what your client is, according to the convictions he already has. And that's how they're all linked. Isn't that exactly what Congress is trying to get at with this recidivist statute?
There is, and I said before, I know that consent is impossible, but in involving here, we're dealing with teenagers, we're dealing with a contact he made in a bar, we're dealing with an older situation where they weren't captive people, they picked their own clothes, they came along to the session. It is categorically different from
same
the behavior
genre.
With the stepchildren. It is
different
the same.
Version of the same genre.
It is the same genre in the broadest possible sense. It's not exactly the same behavior, and it because it doesn't involve. And I'm not going to sit here and argue levels of egregiousness with lascivious behavior with children, but there are some differences. They're not signature crimes, and that's a big difference.
I mean, the fact that your guy would involve himself in this case after having been convicted and kind of knowing that he's being watched, that suggests something that this statute is designed to deal with, somebody who is a predator. And that's the question here. Should he avoid Congress's intent to punish repeat offenders who are predators of children because of this Alford situation?
He is punished. He does receive a serious sentence, and he would receive a serious sentence without the bump up to life. And we do have a case where it goes to the extreme. There is no middle ground here.
Isn't the guideline range 360 months to life without the enhancement?
But this is a mandatory life.
Right, difference. But what do you think is going to happen when it gets remanded for resentencing?
I'm sure that counsel will be able to find an eloquent argument and prevent that from happening.
Is the purpose of this just to sort of emasculate any attempt to deal with an Alford plea?
No. Because a good Alford plea can be used. An Alford plea that's accompanied by some kind of finding of fact or admission of fact, or even if the sentencing judge, in this case, in the instant case, had made some sort of finding. And he didn't. He didn't say.
So on remand, can the judge make those findings? I mean, when you remand for a new sentencing, it kind of start again. And so could those findings be made on remand?
The judge, I have to concede, the judge can reach a life sentence by several different avenues. Right? But in the same time.
Is one of them investigating what the factual basis for this plea was and making a factual finding that it did involve the requisite conduct?
If you accept that this is a modified categorical approach and you do go back and you look at the actual conduct involved and there is an investigation of the actual conduct and a finding by the district court judge, I would have to concede that is a possibility. But what we have here is a case where someone got a life sentence where the proper steps don't appear to have been taken. And it's also a situation where, quite frankly, in the judge's behalf, not that he needs me as his defense, for his defense, there's not a lot of guidance for him at this point. He was plowing a new field.
Well, and then that makes me wonder, because you argue plain error applies because there was no objection, despite the judge inviting objections several times. And so how can it be plain error if he's plowing new fields?
Because he had an obligation to investigate further the sentence that is this egregious. And when the lawyer says, this is a life sentence, can you come up with something lower than life? Is there some other way you can handle it? He waved it in front of him and said, you need to see something. I'm talking about in terms of how he analyzes it, in terms of does he use a modified categorical approach? What does he do at that point? That's where it would have taken some imagination, just as it's taken a lot of ink in this case, and I think will still take a lot of ink before it's resolved. But the bottom line is here. There should have been some kind of finding. It shouldn't have just been.
Of course, it wasn't objected to.
It wasn't objected to, although the lawyer did speak eloquently on let's go below. I mean, the lawyer spoke eloquently on the point of find something other than life here.
But if, in fact, you look at this plea colloquy and the Alford plea, the only claimed victims were 7 and 9, and any conduct that violated that Louisiana statute, once you narrow it to on the minor, would have violated the analogous federal statute at that age. And so I'm wondering if there's a factual basis for this crime, which there must be in an Alford plea, how can the factual basis be anything other than the 7 and 9-year-old child?
Because I have to respectfully disagree with you, because under the state statute, you can commit a lewd and lascivious act in the presence of a minor and violate that statute.
But the indictment here narrowed that. The indictment said it was upon the minor. And so if we accept that it was upon the minor and that the only facts presented are that the minors were that young, then any lewd act upon the minor would violate the federal act.
I think the word upon there, it depends on what upon means. Upon there could mean also that it's inflicted upon him, but being done in his presence. I think the state statute is a very generous and broad statute. And that's why it needed clarification at the time.
Okay, then let me just be sure I get an answer to my question, though. Assume with me for the moment that it was narrowed to the upon. Okay, just assume arguendo. I won't hold you to it. Is the fact that the only claimed victims were that young then enough under the modified categorical approach? We're not dealing with a 9-year-old and a 16-year-old where the conviction could have been for the 16-year-old, or where we don't know the age. They just said under 17. We have only these two victims, 7 and 9.
If the facts are limited to involve conduct that involves physical contact of some form, then you've satisfied the modified categorical approach by looking at actual conduct.
The indictment didn't state the ages, did it?
No, I think it just said upon them.
All right. Anything else?
That's it. I will save some time for rebuttal.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Good morning, Your Honors. As mentioned, this particular defendant is indeed a sexual predator and has many prior convictions. The issue in this case really boils down to a plain error analysis of his Alford plea and whether it constitutes a federal offense, or a state sex offense under the federal statute 3559E, remembering always that we are dealing with plain error. And there, first of all, has to be error. And defendant's only basis for claiming that there is error is that there is some ambiguity in the state statute. As interpreted by Louisiana state law, there's not a great deal of ambiguity if the indictment actually charges the defendant with lewd and lascivious act upon the person of the victim, and the victim is a minor victim, in this case under 17.
Well, counsel, let me ask you, you're starting at a place that assumes, I think, certain things. Don't we need either the categorical or the modified categorical approach to be applied to this Louisiana statute? Don't we need that vehicle?
I did argue that there is conduct that is the element that should be, that there is a difference between conduct and elements of the offense for
I'm not trying to get you into that argument quite yet. But generally, it seems to me both sides are arguing this under the categorical or modified categorical. You have a statutory argument as well that we can deal with.
Exactly.
But if we go under the categorical and modified categorical, it seems to me this statute is not a very good example of that. There are no elements. Taylor, Shepard, I think Supreme Court is the first one that dealt with the modified categorical approach, and it was looking at elements in the predicate offense, a list. And they're saying we can't, some of these are within the necessary category, some are outside. And by looking at these other papers from the conviction, we can figure out which one this person was convicted of. You can't do that with this statute. There are no elements in the statute to choose from. Doesn't that prevent the use of the modified categorical approach?
No, Your Honor. These are non-traditional type offenses. In Taylor and Shepard, the court was dealing with burglary and a statute that addressed elements of the offense of burglary, and they dealt with common law burglary and then the various statutory elements required. These are non-traditional type offenses that legislatures have drafted and come up with. And so that I believe that is why the federal statutes use the terms relating to in some of them, and they talk in terms of relationships or conduct rather than elements of a specific traditional type offense.
Well, I can understand that, but I think that is a secondary argument. Maybe you're trying to convince me otherwise, but it seems to me if we're dealing with the modified categorical approach in its traditional terms, the analogy here is you take the state statute of conviction and look for elements and see which of those match up with a comparable federal offense, federal sex offense, as opposed to a generic burglary or whatever else. That's how it seems to me modified categorical could work. And the only way to get elements of the Louisiana offense is through case law, not from the statute.
That is correct. The case law does describe what lewd and lascivious acts are, and I've detailed a number of those in my brief, and I'm not prepared to go through all of the details that are there, but the case law does define the term lewd and lascivious, and there are three federal cases that have interpreted different state statutes that use those terms, and I cite those in my brief also. And the court does have to look as to whether it was an act, and that's where we look to the definitions under 2246, whether it was a sexual act or sexual contact. And under 2244A1, which is the closest thing that we can come to the Louisiana statute, there is a requirement for sexual contact. And under the Louisiana law, and as charged, since it was an act upon the child, there was some contact with the between the child and the perpetrator.
So you don't think we need to look to the plea colloquy at all?
I'm thinking you can stop right at the actual charging instrument. You look at the statute, it's broad. Look at the charging instrument, it narrows it to the sexual conduct or the lewd and lascivious act upon the person of the victim.
And that's the state court allowed the plea of molestation.
The state court certainly did after hearing the factual basis. Under Louisiana law, an offered plea cannot be accepted without the term is used, strong factual basis. And the prosecutor in this case, and I quoted it in my supplemental brief, stated exactly what the factual basis was. And defendant, by entering his offered plea, certainly didn't admit to everything and say, I did all of these things. But he's saying, in essence, the government or the state can prove these things and I would be proven guilty. And it was strictly for the purpose of getting the plea agreement. And his plea bargain was he got 5 years probation for this conduct.
So your point would be an offered plea is no different.
The federal courts have said that there is no difference between an offered plea and a guilty plea, and the Louisiana state court treats them the same way also. An offered plea is merely a form of a guilty plea.
So you would have us hold that an offered plea can be used under the doctrines that we're talking about as fully as a guilty plea? You would want us to hold that an offered plea can be used under the doctrines that we're talking about as fully as can a guilty plea. You would suggest we would make that holding.
I would suggest that it could be.
But that's not
because it is a guilty plea.
But there's no precedent for that. There has to be something other than the offer.
I can find no precedent for that. The few cases, in fact, the cases that you pointed us to discuss, there was discussion on the issue, and it wasn't even under plain error review. It was there had been an objection at the district court level to the application of the offered plea. In this case, no objection whatsoever.
Well, the distinction that those cases would have us at least consider is that you either would have a jury finding of the necessary elements, or you would have an admission, the equivalent of a jury finding. We don't have that here. I know you're saying, when the fellow admitted that the jury would likely find me guilty, all that is saying, with whatever the reality is behind it, is I don't think I can successfully show my innocence or create a reasonable doubt. That's not an admission. It seems to me that's the equivalent of a jury finding.
I agree with you. It's not an admission. But the Supreme Court used the term assent, and that is something less than an admission. It's more than standing silent. And he did plead guilty. He did say, I plead guilty under Alford.
I think we have the argument. I'm not sure.
If you have any other questions, thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Kraft, you have anything? Want to invoke the...
I just want to say that in order to go as far as the government would want you to go, you'd have to think that an offer plea is a reliable indicator of anything other than that the defendant wanted to get a sentence and get out of there. And that's what we have in the situation. He's getting a suspended sentence and walking out the door. And that's not a reliable indication of what the underlying facts were.
But he was told in that plea colloquy that it could be used to enhance a future sentence. So he was aware that it wasn't just, well, la-di-da, I'll just say I'm guilty of this and leave and everything's cool. I mean, he was told that during that plea colloquy,
but
and that's kind of significant.
And he has to be told that, but that's what's aimed there, and I bet you dollars to donuts right now than what they were talking about there. And what's thought is taught there is, the state revitivist statute 15529.1, where you're going to be multiple billed on the basis of it later. And you do have to be told that because a nolo plea can have different recidivist effects later. So there's an indication there. But it's not a reliable predictor as to what the underlying facts were. Because he's saying, well, look at the emotions of the situation. There are lots of reasons to plead guilty. The emotions of the situation are, if a case like this goes in front of a jury, the jury's going to want to say guilty right off the bat. He's going to go in with a lot of prejudice against him. He's got an offer of probation, and he's going to take it for his own self-defense. So it doesn't really indicate what his conduct are. And under a modified categorical approach, which I think the court has properly identified as the right approach here, there's got to be some other indication, some reliable indication of what the actual conduct was.
Right.
As always, it's very, very much a pleasure to argue in front of this court.
All right, you're court appointed. We appreciate
your
service.
Thank you.
Thank you.